clear to him that he is an object to be used however the adult male wishes. It's part of the general humiliation of the adolescent during the process of initiation. Now, to look for a bit at the form of the theory which suggests that Greek homosexuality as a general phenomenon spread through the Greek world from the initiatory procedures of Dorian tribes. There is one rather striking difference between the Dorian practices, as we see them in Crete and Sparta, and the general phenomenon. The general phenomenon throughout the Greek world has a very strong insistence on beauty, physical beauty, as the visual stimulus, the crucial stimulus to homosexual desire. On the other hand, Ephorus alleges about the Cretan practice that the older male picks on the young male, he chooses the young male, not by the criterion of visual beauty, but on grounds of character, ability, discipline, and so on. And Xenophon alleges the same thing about homosexual choice at Sparta. Xenophon also, this is in his little treatise about the Spartan constitution, Xenophon also alleges that at Sparta, the idea that there could be anything physical in a homosexual relationship is regarded with abhorrence, and that the Spartan older male and younger male never get any further than touching of right hands. Xenophon adds, I know that my readers will find this hard to believe because it is otherwise in the rest of the Greek world, but he asserts it is true of Sparta. Well now, if this is true of Crete and Sparta, if it was the character of the young male and not his beauty which attracted the older male, if that is true, then the spread of homosexuality throughout the rest of the Greek world from Spartan and Cretan procedures seems a little rocky, when the reason for homosexual love, homosexual activity in the rest of the Greek world is plainly quite different. On the other hand, if the statement about Crete and Sparta is untrue, if it was in fact physical attributes which attracted them, then why did they put up the pretense that it wasn't? Whom did they have to deceive and why? Now, there's considerable emphasis laid in Putzer's book on the educational element in a homosexual relationship, the fact that the older male is the teacher and guide of the younger male. And this is one thing which is very important in Putzer's argument. But I'm not sure that it means quite as much as he thinks it does. Because given the fact that a young male is bound to grow into an adult male, he's bound to become an adult male in due course, then in any such relationship, the older male is necessarily, whether he wills it or not, a model which the younger male can take for imitation. And the idea that the older male is mainly or primarily concerned to train and educate and bring out the virtues in the younger male seems rather to belong to the apologians of homosexuality. But why should homosexuality in the Greek world need an apologia? I think we see the answer to that in the speech which Plato puts into the mouth of Pausanias in the Symposium. Because he represents Pausanias as saying, in effect, and it's saying at considerable length, that the older male is expected to pursue the younger. He's expected to be attracted by handsome boys. Everybody sympathizes with him and encourages him in the pursuit. But all boys are told, don't talk to strange men on your way to school. and everybody vilifies and criticizes any younger male who is caught at the same time as they are encouraging the older male to pursue. It is, as Pausanias says, a very complicated situation at Athens. And of course, in a situation like that, you will naturally get the older male professing concern for the soul and the intellectual development of the younger male, even when it is in fact the body of the younger male which has in the first instance attracted him. Now, a word about the other version of the initiation theory, that is that wherever you find homosexuality in the Greek world, it is a reflex of a prehistoric situation in which initiation involving homosexuality as an integral part was universal. This is the argument particularly of Bernard Sergent, who looks for all those myths in which a hero or a god falls in love with and carries off a young human male. I don't myself find his treatment of myth particularly convincing, because there is rather too much of saying these two things are obviously identical when in point of fact they don't have very much in common. For example, he takes the myth of Pelops as Pindar gives it in the First Olympian. The god Poseidon falls in love with Pelops. He carries him off to Olympus, as Pindar puts it, to serve the same purpose as Ganymede did for Zeus. When Pelops is grown up and his beard is beginning to appear, Poseidon returns Pelops to Earth, and when Pelops seeks the hand in marriage of the daughter of the king of Elis, he prays to Poseidon for help. Poseidon gives him magic horses with which he defeats Enemaus in the chariot race. Now, Sergent compares that with the myth of Laius and Chrysippus, Laius the king of Thebes, who carries off the beautiful young Chrysippus in his chariot from Elis to Boeotia, and Chrysippus thereupon commits suicide. Well, all those two myths have in common, it seems to me, is a chariot. But Sergent argues, you see, that they are both reflexes of an institution of initiation in which the adult male teaches the younger male how to drive a chariot. In spite of the fact, in both these myths, there's nothing about teaching anybody to drive a chariot, particularly Chrysippus. And again, this sort of explanation doesn't fit very well with the myth of Ganymede, because Zeus, after all, does not snatch Ganymede up to Olympus in order to teach him how to be an adult human. He freezes him in perpetual adolescence, because that's where he wants him to be. And Ganymede does not learn any of the skills or arts except cup-bearing. Now, it is also, I think, very important that whereas in talking about different versions of a myth collected, let us say, from related tribes all at the present time, it is possible to take the line, as Levi Strauss does, that all the different versions are, so to speak, implicit in the one super myth. It's very hard to do that when you're talking about the Greeks, because the Greeks themselves drew attention to the fact that they were innovating in myth, discarding old ones and inventing new ones. For example, Achilles and Patroclus. Aeschylus wished to make Achilles the lover and Patroclus the young male with whom he is in love. He wished to do this in order to explain the extravagant grief of Achilles for the death of Patroclus. Now, that meant he had to discard Homer, because Homer made Patroclus the older of the two and Achilles the younger. So Aeschylus had to reverse that, make Achilles the older, Patroclus the younger. And Plato, in the Symposium, draws attention to the fact that Aeschylus altered the myth in this way. We know also from a passage in Herodotus that whereas everybody had always believed that Artemis was the daughter of Leto, Aeschylus, in some play or other, we don't know which one, made her the daughter of Demeter, agreeing, as Herodotus says, with no other poet. I must say, believe myself that until Aeschylus composed the Oresteia, there was no previous connection whatever between Orestes, the origin of the Areopagus, or the origin of the cult of the Semnae Theae at Athens, and that the composition of those elements into one story was an invention by Aeschylus. The way Pindar talks about the myth of Pelops, the way he tells the myth of Pelops in the First Olympian, strongly suggests to me, as it has strongly suggested to most people, that Pindar is inventing this version of the story and is telling us that he is inventing it. This is not, of course, agreeable to Sergeant because it rather removes from the prehistoric arena one of the stories on which he relies. Now also, what is the mechanism by which an idea like homosexuality integral to initiation, so to speak, goes underground in the prehistoric era and then emerges all over the Greek world by some mysterious sort of folk memory process? I'm a little skeptical over folk memory as a general phenomenon. And what is more, it has to cross, it has to get over or under or round that chronological barrier in the 8th and 7th centuries BC, during which, as it appears from surviving poetry and vase painting, overt homosexuality was not recognized in the Greek world. Those are the reasons, rather concisely expressed, for which I am not at all happy about this current interest in linking Greek homosexuality with procedures of initiation. There is one other aspect, though, I would like to mention as relevant to this, and this arises from Paul Cartledge's article on the political aspects of homosexuality at Sparta. He points out that for a very distinguished Spartan to pick on a boy of another distinguished family is a way of creating the beginnings of a political alliance which may be very useful when that boy has grown up. And it is certainly the case that Ephorus, in talking about the procedures in Crete, does lay great stress on the political standing, the social status and wealth of the adult and the younger male involved. Now, I think this kind of political aspect may have played a slightly larger part and in other Greek communities, including Athens, than we might at first sight have supposed. Because for a boy to be picked on by a distinguished young man of an important political family, for him to be picked on as an object of desire is undeniably flattering. Whatever allowance we make for the situation described in Pausanias' speech and symposium, however often he may have been told, don't talk to strange men on your way to school, the fact remains that in a society where great value is attached to physical beauty, to be told in effect, you are outstandingly beautiful and the son of Themistocles is interested in you, is very flattering. And of course, if a relationship of this kind is established, then the young man, when he grows up, will feel that the older male is under an obligation to him, which can be politically very useful. In rather the same way as Pelops in the First Olympian, when he is returned to the earth from Olympus, he asks Poseidon for a favor, giving Poseidon an opportunity to show his gratitude for the relationship between them, which is now over. In other words, I'm suggesting that in some respects, a homosexual relationship could have the political overtones of an alliance formed by a marriage between families. But of course, if that is so, it still means that we are talking about the political use of a phenomenon already existing, and one which had come into existence for other reasons. Now, finally, of course, it is, I think, fair on occasion to say something about the motives of historians and scholars, especially if one is doing one's best to uncover and declare one's own. I did suggest, in the case of Patsa particularly, that there is a moralistic tone which has done considerable damage to his sense of humour. I do find it a little odd to have it suggested that the older male in a homosexual relationship at Athens is really screwing the boy out of social obligation, and not because he really wants to. But at the same time, I think I ought to declare my own motivation. I have a considerable liking for the trivial and the accidental in historical causation. I am inclined to believe that very widespread and far-reaching phenomena can start from the most trivial beginnings, which can, so to speak, trigger off the realization of a potentiality in what I suppose could be called, in the strict non-judgmental sense of the term, a catastrophic way. And I am rather inclined to that kind of explanation, I think, on the basis of what seemed to me the determinants of linguistic change. So at the end of the day, I have to confess that I haven't changed my mind on this question of the causes or non-causes of Greek homosexuality since 1978. I think I have tried very hard to see the virtues in the linking of this with initiation procedures, and so far it just doesn't convince me. I'm sorry about that, because I believe change of mind is the hallmark of rationality, and I'm always very disturbed when I don't change my mind. But it is only 6 years, after all, since I wrote the book. Thank you very much.
In pursuing a younger male, the older male has got to persuade and convince and cajole himself, you see, in arranging a marriage, for example. He doesn't have to do that. So that this terminology, the opening, doing, I arrange, I assess, and so on, is particularly prominent in cases where he can't just have what he wants like that. He's got to talk the younger male around. I think that's probably why it occurs particularly in homosexual context.
And not with the woman as the pursuer and the man as the pupil. That was what I thought, and the way that you represented the diagram and spoke of the pursuit and avoidance as going between the desirer and the person's desire made me wonder if there were cases of pursuit and avoidance in this last category.
Ah, yes. What I'm doing there in the arrows, really, is showing the direction of desire. Now, that is, I think, a separate point from the terminology used of desire and its pursuit of woman. And that is a correct picture of the way desire goes, because the female can desire the adult male or the young male.
I read in all places, in Harper's Magazine this summer, an interview with Foucault before he died, Michel Foucault, in which he talks about redoing Nietzsche's genealogy of ethics. He makes a considerable mention of this domination theory with adult men, and he says that this may uncover an implicit paradox or contradiction in Greek social theory, where who would later be free citizens, were first dominated. Are you aware of his theories on this, or what writing he's done?
I think that is roughly the position, you see, that you get what I call a dominant-subordinate relationship when you have one of the parties of the transaction positively desiring the other, and the other either refusing or conceding but not desiring. And there's a very interesting passage in Plato's Phaedrus, which is relevant to this, you see, where he is using homosexual relationships as a kind of model for a passion for the idea, the form of beauty, and so on. And he says that when you get an older male who is, in the right sort of philosophical sense, stimulated by the beauty and quality of a younger male, so that he wants to enter into a dialogue of a philosophical kind, the older male feels eros for the younger. And Plato says what the younger feels is actually an eros in return, but he doesn't know that. He calls it philia. Now, which is a general word for love and affection, you see, which does in fact square, I think, with everything else we say about this rather one-way relationship. This is what I meant by dominant and subordinate, really. And of course, I think this vocabulary, pursuing, fleeing, catching, being caught, overthrowing, and so on, squares with that thinking of it in dominant subordinate terms. And one gross physiological detail, which is relevant to that, in these scenes of homosexual intercourse, with one possible exception, a black figure of ours at the British Museum, with just one exception, the penis of the younger male is never erect. He remains unaffected physically by what's going on. In fact, he's usually gazing past the man's shoulder, usually giving us something else.
Are there, another thing that you said interested me, are there, what are the connotations of semen other than the Malinowskian ones that you brought out among the trogrammers, for instance, that the womb is nurtured by semen, it's a nurturing thing. But are there any notions of semen being connected with wisdom and knowledge, and by retaining semen, as you have in the Hindu system, let's say, you retain semen and it goes to the head? Is there any notion of that? Are there times when one should retain it?
Among the Greeks, there's absolutely no trace of that at all. With the solitary exception of the particular Gnostic sect that Epiphanes talks about in the 1st century AD, where there does seem to be an idea of the female deity gaining strength by drawing semen from her male devotees. But that's the only allusion in the Greek language, so far as I know, to any such idea.
The older, younger pairing in the Athenian military have something to do with initiation or certainly education?
Well, there isn't really, you see, a
pairing in the Athenian military setup, because the first 2 years when a male becomes, when military service is required, in 1890, you see he is separately brigaded and used only within the bounds of Attica. And after he passed the age of 20, well then of course he would normally be in the unit made up of members of his own thule and so on. But the idea of pairing the adult and younger male in a homosexual relationship was actually produced and put into effect in Thebes at the beginning of the 370s. And it was the basis of the Hieros Logos, which was destroyed at the Battle of Chaeronea in 338. But it wasn't a particularly Athenian thing. I think one probably only made comparisons with other contemporary societies in which women are secluded and have their personal rights and so on, but overt homosexuality is not tolerated. I think it's helped to make a cross-cultural comparison.
Mm-hmm.